we were talking about the genes that code for antibodies. And that, of course, is genomic control, right? Hopefully that'll come on soon. That's genomic control because the DNA has actually changed, right? That's not the only example of genomic control. Genomic control of what? What are we talking about? Control of what? What's the overall topic? Gene expression, right? In slide 10, we're looking at these puffs in a special kind of cell that actually undergoes multiple rounds of DNA replication without actually undergoing cytokinesis. So it's a big cell with a lot of copies of DNA in it, which makes it easy to look at. That's not really the point. That just makes it easy to microscopically see all of this DNA. This is a huge chromosome because it's actually many, many chromosomes copied together. And what's happening here is that you see these puffs, and those puffs are places where transcription is occurring. And that's because of chromatin remodeling. We've already talked about this, right? Chromatin can be condensed or not as condensed. When it's not as condensed, it's available for transcription. But that's still a change in the DNA, right? And therefore, that's genomic control. This just happened. It's not important that there's multiple copies of the gene of the chromosome here. That just makes it easy to see under light microscopy. But it indicates that certain regions of a chromosome are actively being transcribed because they are being made accessible to the transcription machinery by being remodeled into looser form of DNA so that those enzymes can get in there and do their job of transcription. Well, that happens even in a normal cell with only its regular amount of copies of DNA. And so we can still detect that, even though it's not obvious under light microscopy that that's happening. We're on slide 11 now to show you this example. Two chromosomes here. They're the same chromosome, but they're from different cells of the same multicellular organism. Notice that the purple one is from an erythrocyte, which is what? A red blood cell. And the blue one is from an oviduct. So this is from the same exact individual organism, therefore they're the same DNA, they're just in different cells. Well, different cells in a multicellular organism are different because they have different sets of proteins, right? That they make. Well, they both have the same exact library, though. They're both, in essence, able to make all the proteins that that individual can make, but any given cell doesn't ever end up making all of the proteins. It only makes the proteins that are appropriate for that type of cell to make. All right, so you'd expect an erythrocyte to make a different type of protein, different set of proteins than an oviduct cell. Well, these little loops that are hanging out of the main part of the chromosome are less condensed regions of DNA, and therefore available for transcription. And if you treat these DNA samples with an enzyme called DNase-1, which is it's an example of a nuclease. This is made in your pancreas for digestion because you eat DNA, right, when you eat organisms. That's not the purpose here. The purpose here is that you want to cut this DNA into chunks. But you don't want to do that for the entire chromosome. You don't want to eliminate the chromosome and just make it into a bunch of nucleotides. You want to just ruin the part that is being transcribed, the loose part that's hanging out as a loop. And if you give it a low enough concentration of DNase-1, the enzyme, it won't affect the more condensed part of the chromosome. It will only digest the uncondensed part that's being transcribed. So that's why these little loops are being chopped into little bits by the DNA's one. Then if you take what's left of the DNA and you isolate it, purify it, and if you put it under electrophoresis and hybridize it, which means expose it to other nucleic acids, other DNA to which it might be complementary, then you can see whether that hybridization probe is found. And notice that the gene for globin is absent in the erythrocyte, and the gene for ovalbumin is absent in the oviduct cell. And that's because those were the loops that got digested by the DNAs. In other words, this is saying that the erythrocyte is making its globin part of its genome, its gene for globin, which is a component of hemoglobin and therefore part of the red blood cell's job. That's what that loop was for. It's making it accessible by being less condensed. Whereas the ovalbumin gene has no business being transcribed in an erythrocyte, and therefore it's kept it as heterochromatin, more condensed and unavailable. It didn't get digested by the DNA's one. Just the opposite for the ovalbumin, right? That's the appropriate thing to protein for the oviduct cell to make. It has no business making globin, and therefore the globin gene was found because it wasn't digested. The ovalbumin gene was digested because it was being used. It was loose DNA. So that is still control at the genome level, right? Because you're remodeling DNA in order to affect gene expression. In 12, we can see yet another way of doing this. What's happening here is methylation. Methylation refers to sticking a methyl group onto something else, onto some molecule. In this case, what's being methylated are cytosines within the DNA. Notice the CH3, CH3 is a methyl group. If you put a CH3 there instead of the H that was there originally, that's methylation. And this is a common way for DNA to be switched on or off, basically, because the methylation, if it occurs, means that transcription factors, which are normally able to bind to the DNA and need to in order for transcription to occur, cannot bind there with the methyl groups in place. So methylation prevents binding of transcription factors and therefore drastically turns down transcription of whatever gene is nearby. This, by the way, is also how bacteria protect their own DNA from the restriction enzymes that they make. They evolve restriction enzymes as a way to break the viral DNA that they might be exposed to, because the virus is going to inject DNA. Well, that's only dangerous if it's allowed to be transcribed and translated. So they break it up into pieces, but they don't affect their own DNA with those enzymes because they methylate their own DNA. The bottom part shows you that methylated DNA can be bound by other kinds of proteins, not the transcription factors, but proteins that actually then recruit still other proteins, including, in this case, histone deacetylase. Now, histones can be either methylated or acetylated. Acetylation makes the histones looser, makes the nucleosome, makes the chromatin looser. Okay, so when the histones are acetylated, that makes for remodeling such that the DNA is in a looser configuration and therefore can be transcribed. Deacetylation means taking that acetyl group off. And so that would make it go back into the more compact heterochromatin form. All right? But two things are happening. There's two different ways that the transcription is being turned off. More of a quick way of just turning it off temporarily with methylation of the DNA just to interfere with transcription factors. And then if that continues, you can make it even more permanently turned off by remodeling the chromatin into heterochromatin because of what's happening with the histones. And we can see that in slide 13. This methylated DNA interacts with the various proteins that have the effect of interacting with the histones that make up the nucleosomes. That's what these eight histones are that form one nucleosome along with the DNA that's wrapped around it. Well, that causes those nucleosomes to condense more. That's what heterochromatin is, condensed DNA. It's unavailable for transcription. Here we're looking at an example using this cat as a representative mammal of another way in which the DNA itself can be changed. So this is another example of genomic control. What we're looking at here is what's called X chromosome inactivation. And X chromosome inactivation is a way to accomplish what's called dosage compensation. The dosage here refers to the number of chromosomes of the X type. Mammals are sexual organisms. They have sex chromosomes. Their versions of sex chromosomes are X and Y. They use the XY system. Other animals use other systems. But anyway, if a mammal has two X chromosomes, it is genetically a female. Whether it develops into a female is a different question, but genetically it would be a female. If it's an X and a Y, it's genetically a male. Therefore, male mammals have only one X chromosome, whereas female mammals have two. In other words, females have a double dose of all the genes that are on the X chromosome. They have two of each of those. Those genes that are on an X chromosome are called X-linked genes. All right, so there's a double dose. In order to put the two sexes on equal footing as far as their dosage of X chromosome genes, there is dosage compensation. And in mammals, that's accomplished by bringing females down to the level of the male, basically, by inactivating an entire X chromosome, and therefore all the genes that are on that X chromosome. That's why it's called X chromosome inactivation. And this occurs during embryonic development. Very few cells early on, right? Just a mass of cells that will eventually become the cat, in this case. But each one of those individual cells in that multicellular embryo undergoes X chromosome inactivation. And what happens that in each cell, one of the two X chromosomes randomly gets chosen, and that X chromosome gets inactivated by proteins that interact with it and cause RNA, a special kind of RNA, to be transcribed over and over, and it ends up coding the actual chromosome, which then recruits proteins to come and stick to it as well, and that basically inactivates the entire chromosome for the whole life of that cell and for all the cells that that cell gives rise to. So this happens randomly in each embryonic cell. But each embryonic cell is in a position on the embryo, right? When it undergoes mitosis, and then its progeny cells undergo mitosis, and it becomes more and more multicellular, whatever that original cell had as its inactivated X chromosome, all the children of that cell, all the descendants of that cell will have that same one inactivated. So that part of the body of the adult that the embryo becomes will have that X chromosome inactivated. Well, if the female, if you have a female mammal, it's of course by definition XX. And therefore, a female could be heterozygous with respect to a gene on an X chromosome, meaning that one of the X chromosomes has one version, one allele for that gene, the other one has another allele. In this case, the gene we care about is for hair color. So it can be orangish fur or black fur, depending on what the allele is. Well, if the female is heterozygous, each cell is going to inactivate either the black fur allele or the orange fur allele, and therefore you have the other phenotype, whichever one is not inactivated. And this is why the body of the cat is randomly orange places and black other places. It depends on which cell originally in the embryo, I mean which chromosome in the embryo got inactivated at that cell, in that position of the body. And that's a permanent thing for the rest of the cat's life. It doesn't happen in cells that become gametes, because if you permanently deactivated a gamete, you wouldn't have any progeny, right? But for the somatic cells, it's permanently inactivated for the lifetime of that individual. By the way, a similar thing happens with female humans with respect to the ability to sweat. We call these heterozygous female mammals mosaics because it's just a random scattering of phenotypes. With the ability to sweat, a female that is such a heterozygote, a mosaic, would have patches of skin that can sweat, patches of skin that can't. Okay, 15. We've been looking at genomic control. The next level down is control of transcription itself, right? So genomic control, one way or another, we've looked at many ways it can happen, but one way or another, genomic control prevents transcription because of actual changes in the DNA. Transcriptional control can allow or prevent transcription in DNA that's accessible. In other words, if DNA is not coiled tightly and it is accessible, that still doesn't mean it's necessarily going to be transcribed. There's ways for the cell to turn genes on or off in loose DNA, and we've already talked about this, right? And in this chapter, we talked about how it happens in bacteria, for instance, with the operon control. So transcriptional control is the next level down for overall control of gene expression. And so we once again have two different kinds of cells from the same individual, therefore the same DNA, liver tissue, brain tissue. Well, liver cells are going to produce a different set of proteins compared to brain cells. And the question is, are the proteins being transcribed? I mean, are the proteins that don't exist in liver tissue, but that do exist in brain tissue, are they not there because the DNA has been tightly coiled, which would be genomic control, or simply because transcription has been turned off in accessible genes, which would be transcriptional control? Well, the way to figure that out is shown here. If you allow transcription to occur, but you incubate these cells in an environment that contains radio-labeled nucleotides, they're radioactive, then by detecting the radioactivity, you can tell where these nucleotides go. You can visualize where the mRNA is, basically. So you allow mRNA to be made, and once they are made, then you hybridize them to liver-specific or brain-specific gene sequences. The gene sequences are DNA, of course, but they should be complementary to the mRNA, right? And therefore they should come together if both of them exist. Well, they have gene sequences from both types of cell here, but only one of them hybridizes, meaning that transcription is turned off in the one in which it doesn't show up. Does that make sense? So what this means is it's not control beyond transcription, because if you remember, you can have control after transcription as well, post-transcriptional control. Well, if it's post-transcriptional control, that would mean the mRNA is produced, even though the protein wouldn't be. Here, we don't even find the mRNA, so that means transcription itself has been prevented. That's transcriptional control. 16 is a stretch of DNA showing you a gene. And part about this that we've talked about some of this already. There's a core promoter, and the promoter is not only a region at which RNA polymerase binds in order for transcription to occur, but also proteins bind there. And what do we call proteins that bind to the promoter? What'd you say? Transcription factors. Okay, transcription factors come in two major categories. There are general transcription factors, and there are regulatory transcription factors. General transcription factors are proteins that bind to all promoters. They're basically necessary to help the RNA polymerase to get bound to the promoter and start transcription. That's why they're called general. They're not gene-specific. All right. The regulatory transcription factors are other proteins. These factors are proteins. They're other proteins that bind elsewhere to DNA and can turn on or turn off, or I should say, turn up or turn down the transcription of specific genes. All right. So if all you have, for instance, is generalized transcription factors, there might be a low level of transcription. You make some copies of messenger RNA, but just not all that many, and therefore you don't end up making many of the corresponding proteins. But a regulatory transcription factor can greatly speed up transcription. I shouldn't say speed up, ramp it up. Meaning that you're going to make a lot more messenger RNA of that type and therefore make a lot more of the protein that it codes for. Or a regulatory transcription factor could shut it off so that you're just not making any. Well, there are places on the DNA other than the promoter at which these regulatory transcription factors bind. And those might be very close to the gene. They might not be close at all. There are some important sites that are close to the actual core promoter, which is right by the gene itself. And that's why these places are called proximal control elements. Now, control elements in general are sequences of DNA. They are the sequences of DNA that get bound to these regulatory transcription factors. The transcription factors bind to control elements in the DNA. The proximal control elements, though, we see this happening. They're very similar from gene to gene, and they are basically in the same position just upstream of the core promoter, within about 100 base pairs of the core promoter. And that's why they're called proximal, which means close to. There are other control elements, though, that are very far away, and they still can affect that gene from a distance. We'll look at how that happens in a minute. But the proteins that that bind to the core promoter are the general transcription factors. The ones that bind to the control elements are regulatory transcription factors. In 17, we're looking at examples of these ones that are not necessarily close. I say not necessarily close because they're also not necessarily very far away. These are not they're not categorized as proximal control elements because they're just not in that group of ones that occur all the time. We see it happening over and over with different genes. These used to be called distal control elements, meaning far away, but they're not necessarily far away. Some of them are also close. But they're control elements, and they therefore are sequences of DNA that can bind to regulatory transcription factors, the proteins themselves. Well, the proteins, the transcription factors, are the little spheres. The control elements, being DNA, are the colored segments within the stretch of DNA, within the, not the gene, but the chromosome, right? It's between genes. Well, notice that control elements can be called either enhancers or silencers, depending on how they operate. They're control elements, though, so those are DNA sequences. The proteins, which are the regulatory transcription factors that bind to enhancers, are called activators. So once again, the terminology is going to drive you nuts. Activators are transcription factors, they're proteins. They bind to enhancers, which is DNA. And so activators obviously are going to have the effect of increasing transcription of the gene. Now, that, like I said, that gene might be next door, it might be way far away from this enhancer site, but it still gets affected if an activator binds to that enhancer. A DNA sequence, though, a regulatory sequence that has the effect when it is bound by a transcription factor of turning down transcription is called a silencer. And the protein itself, the transcription factor that binds to a silencer, is called a repressor. All right? So the regulatory proteins, transcription factors, are either activators or repressors. Same terminology as in bacteria, but we're looking at eukaryotic genes here, or eukaryotic DNA. The DNA sequences are, the corresponding ones are enhancers and silencers. Well, there are also control elements called insulators. That's the purple version down at the bottom. And insulators actually have an indirect effect. Insulators can, as the name implies, keep an enhancer or a silencer from working. All right, so notice that this activator, which is the yellow protein, has bound to its corresponding enhancer, the DNA, which would normally turn on a gene, or in this case, two different genes. Gene 1 and gene 2 going in opposite directions. Well, gene 1 does get turned on, but gene 2 gets prevented from being turned on by the activator-enhancer combination because the insulator prevents it. So just another level of complexity. In 18, we can see how an activator binding to an enhancer far away from a gene that it controls can still control that gene. So just for simplicity here, we're looking at two activators binding to two enhancers. Usually it's many more than just two. But the point is still the same. If the activators bind to the enhancers, that has the effect of bending the DNA, looping it around so that other proteins that come in and bind to the activators that are bound to the enhancers can then interact with still other proteins, including the general transcription factors at the promoter of the gene to get this whole thing going transcription-wise. All right. 19. Notice we have three cell types here, and that what's doesn't matter what they are, just they're different types of cells. And they therefore are performing different kinds of jobs within the same organism, and they therefore should be, shouldn't be a surprise that they are going to produce different kinds of proteins. Well, they're producing different kinds of proteins in this case because of control at the transcription level. In other words, the genes are available in all of those cells. They're not coiled up into heterochromatin. The genes are available for transcription, but they're either turned on or off. Or turned up or down, I should say, more correctly. Because it what depends here is the suite or the collection of particular proteins involved. In cell one, notice that we have the gene, whatever it is, being transcribed at a low level. And this is what I was talking about before when I said if you only have general transcription factors, which all cells do, that's why they're general transcription factors. They work the same way in all genes and all cells. Then you'll have some transcription, just you're not going to make very much, a low level of transcription. Now, there are regulatory transcription factors in this cell. They just aren't the right kind of regulatory transcription factors to turn this particular gene on. Right? This is analogous to a hormone in your body not having any effect at a certain cell because that certain cell doesn't happen to have the right receptor for that particular protein or for that particular hormone. So, wrong set of regulatory transcription factors for this gene. These transcription factors affect some other gene in the same cell, but not this one. On the other hand, in cell type 2, there's a different collection of regulatory proteins, transcription factors. And these ones are appropriate for this gene, and therefore, it's not just being transcribed at a low level, it's very much ramped up. You end up making a lot more of the corresponding protein in this cell, which is appropriate because those transcription factors are basically signals telling it this is something you need. Cell 3 doesn't have any need at all for that type of protein. And so among its collection of transcription factors are repressors that actually keep it even from being basal. Right, the repressors will turn the gene off, and therefore none of that protein is made, at least as long as that repressor is present. Remember that the collection of proteins that exist in a cell changes. It's not continuous. It changes depending on the conditions. So genes can be turned on or off by exercising control at the transcription level. All right, now 20. Here's another example of a control element. These ones are called response elements, but it is a control element, meaning that it is DNA. In this case, though, we have the response element is a DNA part that responds to the presence of steroid hormones. Now, steroid hormones share among them the fact that they are hydrophobic. Right? There are hydrophilic hormones and there are hydrophobic ones. Hydrophobic ones can easily pass through plasma membranes because they don't have any problem being by those hydrophobic tails, right? And so that's what all of your steroid hormones have in common. Well, they all come from cholesterol. They're modified cholesterols, but that's a lipid, so that's why they're hydrophobic. And therefore, they can enter cells. They can not only enter the cell, they can actually enter the nucleus as well. Most of your hormones can't. All they can do is knock on the door at the cell surface and cause something to happen. We'll talk about that later. Hormones, though, can come in. Well, hormones are signals, and any signal molecule has an effect only if it can bind to a receptor. All right? In the case of steroid hormones, The reason they have an effect is because when they enter the cell, they encounter their specific receptor. And the S here is the steroid hormone, in this case cortisol, a stress hormone. The receptor itself is the GR. All right, that's a protein. Proteins are receptors. If the steroid binds to its receptor, then that receptor steroid complex, the S and the GR combined, are able to go into the nucleus and bind to that control element that we're here calling a glucocorticoid response element. Right? The response element is the DNA sequence that the complex of hormone and receptor can bind to. And when they do that, then they activate the transcription of genes. All right, so it's things are happening the same way we talked about really before. It's just using the hormone as the signal. The thing that keeps, well, let me just say that one important thing about this is that if you think back to bacteria, they organize related genes or genes that need to be made at the same time or not at all into operons, right? Like we talked about. That makes sense. Well, operons are rare in eukaryotes, but it's not rare for a bunch of different genes that are serving a common function, like all the genes of a certain pathway, for instance. I mean, all the proteins of a certain pathway to be produced at once. It's not unusual for all of those genes to be turned on at once or turned off at once. The thing is, they're not organized into operons in a eukaryotic cell. They are scattered, maybe even into different chromosomes. They're all over the place. But a eukaryotic cell needs to be able to turn all of them on at once or turn all of them off at once. And the way it does that is with these, for instance, these response elements. Some sort of control element, in this case a response element. All right? There's not just one of these response elements. There's a response element for each of the genes coding for a protein that's part of this group that needs to be turned on all at once or off all at once. See what I'm saying? So that in response to, in this case, glucocorticoid, which is what the cortisol is, it's a glucocorticoid hormone, it will, you know, you don't just have one molecule of cortisol. You have many. So you therefore have many copies of this hormone receptor complex. They're going to find all of these response elements of the same type, each of which corresponds to one of the genes necessary to be turned on. That's why, even though they're scattered throughout the genome, all the genes get turned on at once, just like in an operon. It's just doing it, accomplishing it in a different way. And, well, in the top of this, by the way, just shows you that different steroid hormones have different response elements, which you would expect, right? Otherwise, the different hormones would all work the same way. You want different hormones to have different effects, to turn on different sets of genes. The different genes get turned on because each gene will have a response element corresponding to one hormone and not another. In 21, we see yet another way in which transcription can be activated or deactivated. And this one involves cyclic AMP, which we've talked about a little bit in here, right? Cyclic AMP is a modified form of AMP, adenosine monophosphate. Just one phosphate, but it's cyclic AMP because there's a bond, not only the original bond that holds that phosphate, but then another phosphate bond that goes back onto the molecule and it forms a ring, which is why it's called cyclic. Well, that's a commonly used signal, and we'll talk much more about it in a different chapter, actually. But there are genes that are controlled by response elements that are triggered by cyclic AMP. Presence or absence of cyclic AMP, it matters, in other words. And that's why this thing is called CRE, cyclic AMP response element. is what the CRE stands for. As you would expect for a response element, that is DNA. That's the rectangle here. It's just part of the DNA. It's a sequence of nucleotides. That doesn't have any effect, of course, unless the appropriate kind of protein comes along and binds to it, right? Well, that protein is CREB here, which is just simply means CRE binding protein, or cyclic AMP response element binding protein. Or if you really want to drag it out, cyclic adenosine monophosphate response element binding protein. But it's easier to just say CREB. Okay, now what about cyclic AMP, though? Because CREB is not cyclic AMP. CREB actually is a switchable protein. A common theme in cell biology is that proteins can be switched into one configuration or another quickly, and therefore either activated or deactivated by phosphorylating or dephosphorylating that protein. Methylation is a different way. That was kind of a switch as well, right? You can switch something either on or off by methylating it. It's also common for things to be phosphorylated. And CREB is an example of something that can be either phosphorylated or dephosphorylated. Now, what do we call things that, enzymes that are responsible for phosphorylation? Not phosphatases. Kinases, right. A kinase is an enzyme that phosphorylates something else. In this case, protein kinase A is the particular kinase that is responsible for phosphorylating CREB. Now, protein kinase A, it phosphorylates all kinds of other things as well. But it includes CREB in its list of things that it can phosphorylate. When do we have protein kinase A being produced in abundance in the cell, though? When cyclic AMP is present. And that's why cyclic AMP matters to this whole thing. If cyclic AMP exists, then that ends up serving as a signal in the cell to activate protein kinase A, which then phosphorylates CRE binding protein. And when it's in its phosphorylated configuration, notice that CBP can come along, which stands for CREB binding protein. CREB itself is a binding protein, but there's a protein that binds to the binding protein, which is CBP. And notice if all of that happens, then transcription gets activated. So the transcription, the bottom line is that the transcription of the gene is sensitive to the presence or absence of cyclic AMP, just indirectly, using these transcription factors, though, which are either able to or not able to bind to response elements in the DNA. All right, 22. We've looked at genomic control, we've looked at transcriptional control, or some examples at least, not an exhaustive list of the complexity involved. Now we're going to look at some homeotic genes, as they're called. And we're looking at fruit flies here to begin with, just to introduce the notion of control of developmental genes. All right, now, so we're restricting our attention here to multicellular organisms. Multicellular organisms are fundamentally different from unicellular organisms in that they have different types of cells, right? Cells that specialize in some function. But keep in mind that in a multicellular organism, all those cells have the same DNA library. So some cells are going to be transcribed, some genes are going to be transcribed in some cells, others are not. And the opposite is true for cells elsewhere in the same organism. Well, that is really important to development, right? With the process of becoming that type of organism from the one cell that it starts out as. In other words, you don't become multicellular simply by adding cells. That would really be a colonial lifestyle rather than a multicellular organism, right? Individual cells that happen to be stuck together are not really a multicellular organism. That's just a colonial lifestyle for individual cells stuck together. And that's how multicellularity evolved through that stage. But anyway, true multicellularity means that individual has different types of cells doing different things. And that doesn't just happen. It happens in the process of development, which includes differentiation. Differentiation refers to cells not only coming into existence, but then specializing. And this happens when stem cells give rise to cells that then become one type of cell or another, right? And they're then, and they can divide themselves, but they're only going to produce more cells of that type. Early on, though, that those embryonic stem cells can become any type of cell in the body. So they differentiate, they become different kinds of cells, really by virtue of turning certain genes on and turning other genes off, and therefore ending up producing different sets of proteins. It's the proteins that really make the cells of different type. All right? So development is a time during which gene control of gene expression is particularly important. It's always important, of course, but it can really affect the entire lifetime of the organism if things don't go right developmentally. And things don't always go right. We can see a wild-type Drosophila fruit fly on the left. Everything has gone well in this one. It's normal-looking. But there are all kinds of mutants that look drastically different in terms of their form, but not because of a huge genetic difference, right? This is also, by the way, how it's not necessary for there to be huge genetic changes to account for big changes between species in the process of speciation during evolution. Even small mutations, if they are mutations that affect developmental genes, can have a drastic effect on the form, which is why we can share a huge fraction of DNA with organisms that are completely different looking from us. Not because our DNA has changed all that much, just because the particular DNA that has changed is important to development. So you have a bithorax mutant, double set of wings, right? Not because of a huge change. The only change that needs to be made is that a gene that's supposed to be turned off and therefore not lead to wing formation does not get turned off. And therefore you make another wing in that position where it shouldn't be. Same with the Antennapedia mutant, which is growing legs where it should have antennae only. They look just like legs where legs are supposed to be, they're just in the wrong place. So this shows you that every cell in a multicellular organism has the potential to make any structure of the body. It's just that normally they don't, right? Your kidneys should not normally be growing toenails, but they can because they have the library. They have the whole library. So control of genes that are invoked during development is a very big deal, and we call such genes homeotic genes. Homeotic genes are, they affect development because the proteins that the homeotic genes code for are proteins that then interact with DNA at these control elements we've been talking about in order to turn genes on or off during development. And therefore, since it's turned on or off during development, that affects the entire lifetime of the organism because it makes it develop one way or another. And what you see here in the cartoon is that a homeotic gene, which is just a normal gene in terms of its sequence of DNA, but somewhere in that gene there is what's called a homeobox. That's a stretch of nucleotides within the overall gene that corresponds in the protein product that the gene codes for to what is called a homeodomain. So the homeobox is part of the gene, that's DNA. The homeodomain that it corresponds to or codes for is part of the protein, the gene product of the homeotic gene. Well, that protein's homeodomain is the part of that protein that allows it to interact with a particular part of DNA. That would be a control element in the DNA, all right? That's one domain. Remember, proteins are broken into domains. Even a single polypeptide can have multiple domains, which is just part of its shape, giving it a certain function. The homeodomain allows it to interact with the DNA. The transcription activator domain allows it to actually interact with other proteins of transcription and therefore affect whether transcription occurs. All right, let's leave it at that.